We cannot let our guard down. I'm in frequent communication with the County Department of Public Health and with the governor and our state government, and all options remain on the table. We will do whatever is necessary to limit the spread of COVID-19, because improving our public health is the vehicle to reopen our schools and to keep our economy moving forward.
LA Mayor Eric Garcetti earlier this week, well, LA is in bad shape right now. Over the past week, more than 10% of coronavirus tests have come back positive, meaning Los Angeles is failing the state's benchmark for reopening. Hospitalizations here are at their highest ever since the beginning of the pandemic back in March. But unlike them, a lot of businesses remain open. Gyms, hair salons, retail stores. So far, deaths have not dramatically spiked, though they have inched up. And here to talk about what the county is doing to slow the spread of the virus is Supervisor Mark Ridley Thomas. His district spans parts of Koreatown down to Carson. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, I'm delighted to have you. So why is the county allowing these businesses to stay open while the virus surges?
Well, the issue before us is simply this. We want to be as clear and as consistent as we possibly can be with regard to balancing the huge challenges that are before us. It was not anticipated that there would be a surge. Be reminded of the fact, going back to early March, there was a sense that there would be a surge, and the hospitals prepared. The county health departments did, from mental health to health services and to public health, three different departments. They went to work, the lead department being the public health department. And then we, to our great surprise, were not overwhelmed in this environment in terms of hospitalizations. And it gave some level of confidence that we could begin to relax. We did that in coordination with the state. We issued orders that followed the state's lead. And only in instances where we thought that that would be problematic for Los Angeles County did we differ by appealing to the state for certain kinds of dispensation.
However, sir, the state threshold for reopening is fewer than 8% of positive tests. And
right.
As I said, we are now over 10%. So is now the time to reconsider and to close down some of the businesses that have been allowed to open?
No, there's no way to deny the fact that all of this has to be revisited. It is an unfortunate turn of events, undeniably. But there's a sense in which we are working as hard as is humanly possible to encourage people to social distance, to encourage people to use the mask. And there's a lot of resistance in the environment. And so the question is, how do you get people to comply and behave in their own best interest and the best interest of the communities of which they are part?
And well,
so
one of the problems is
before than there is now. Now, you can impose this, but the question is, will people be willing to follow the orders? And we are trying as best as possible to move this forward, not only the county of Los Angeles, other counties throughout the state. The governor himself is trying to measure how we can get to efficacy in a way that doesn't end up compounding the economic crisis in which the state and our counties find themselves.
Right. So that is a very real crisis, and unemployment, the extra unemployment benefits are running out at the end of the month. How much of that is in your thought process as you weigh the public health problems, the very urgent public health problems of keeping businesses open and de facto allowing people to congregate at these businesses versus the need for people to earn a living?
Well, you've crystallized it quite capably, and we have to figure out how to reconcile these tensions. We did, in effect, relax the orders and only to find that the virus came roaring back. This was not anticipated, and it's been acknowledged that we can't do that again. And then the question is, can we get this to settle down? That is yet unclear, but there are multiple factors here. We have less than helpful communication from the White House on this. We have a range of concerns in terms of how schools come online. We have issues that say unemployment is rising to depression-like levels across the nation, which will push homelessness, which is a crisis all unto itself, a crisis all unto itself. And we are then faced with big, big, big challenges. And so this is not at all simple. And the Department of Public Health that is responsible for the enforcement and inspection is working overtime to deal with businesses that are not in compliance and so forth. And yet we are trying to respect the fact that people do need to get to work.
But at this point, why not shut it down like you did in March for a few weeks at least to, in order to get a handle on this? Because it appears that, I mean, you're talking about conflicting messages. It appears the county itself is issuing conflicting messages by urging people to stay home, saying this is a, you know, a crisis, and yet allowing these businesses to stay open, allowing beaches to stay open, allowing trails to be open. It does send conflicting messages to the people.
There is no denying the fact that there are conflicting messages being communicated. It's in the interest of trying to find or arrive at a place that is the most reasonable and that maximizes compliance. And while there's a lot of talk about...
What can we expect from you next week from the Board of Supervisors in regards to this?
What can be expected next week? To pay close attention to the data in terms of what the testing is looking like and what the death rate looks like, and to have to make very, very tough decisions. But when doing so, if we precipitate a lack of compliance, then the question is, where do we go? We say, for example, the startling circumstance we had when we said we were going to close the beaches over the 4th of July, 4th of July weekend, right? Mm-hmm. And you have to have enforcement in order to make sure that people are in compliance. Well, the sheriff issued a statement that he would not enforce the order. Would not at the beaches.
But it did look like people stayed away from the beaches. So when you do...
I'm making the point that you have to have full cooperation from everyone in order for it to work. And so this is massive. It's coming very, very fast. We are trying to respect the fact that if businesses continue to fall down, that is not good for communities. And at the same time, we have to make sure that people are safe when they go to a particular business, no matter what that business may be, a restaurant, a bank, et cetera. And we have looked specifically at those businesses that we know are most problematic. For example, bars, and we've tried to be as reasonable as we can, but we had to say absolutely not. They have to be closed down. There was some pushback on that.
And so this it is a difficult act. I'm sorry I have to cut you off there. We've just run out of time, but I do thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay.
That's LA County Supervisor Mark Ridley-Thomas. So we need a shot of hope right about now. And here it is, plasma. New research suggests a shot of plasma from people who've had COVID-19 may inoculate people who haven't had it. But for some reason, federal regulators and drug makers are not actively pursuing this option. That's according to Emily Baumgartner. She's an investigative reporter for the Los Angeles Times who covers science and medicine, and she's been looking into this. Welcome.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Well, this sounds really exciting. Can you talk about what this is, this plasma inoculation?
Certainly. A lot of scientists believe that much like past diseases, coronavirus can be combated using antibodies that are derived from survivors. So in the blood of survivors, and if you use those and concentrate them, you can make all sorts of products that would either prevent or treat the infection in a new patient.
And what's the difference between that and a vaccine in terms of how it works and how it's derived?
So there's two different mechanisms at play here. A vaccine is a synthetic product that you'd use a bit of the virus itself to generate your own body's reaction to that vaccine, to get your body to produce antibodies to fight it. What we're talking about here is called passive immunity. That means taking antibodies from a person who's already generated that response and just adding those to a person who hasn't. So instead of fighting the virus yourself, you're essentially administering the defense mechanism inside a new person.
And what are the differences in effects? Is this treatment, how effective is it compared to a vaccine?
We don't know effectiveness data yet, just as we don't have that data from a vaccine. So what a lot of the researchers are calling for in the reporting that we've done is simply the trials. They're asking that this product that has worked well in past diseases should be manufactured and scaled up for testing so that researchers can evaluate whether this is a safe and effective option. That's what's going on right now around the country with antibody products you've probably heard about being used in hospital wards on IV drips for folks who have already contracted coronavirus. So what they're arguing for here is to do the same thing as a preventative measure for people who have not yet contracted the virus.
And is that being done elsewhere, like in China or in Italy, which has already experienced the heights of the pandemic?
We don't know of any other country who is using this method. The reason this is not a well-known mechanism that you would have been thinking about months ago is that preventative shots, they work in a short-term fashion. So many of them became far less popular when vaccines were deployed. They're not the moneymaker for pharmaceutical companies at all. You may have heard about getting them for rabies or for a couple of different diseases before you go on a trip for a couple of weeks. But this isn't normally the intervention that, you know, advanced medicine would be pursuing. So this is sort of a return to an old-fashioned technology that could work for us in the short term.
So when you say short term, how long would it last? How long would it be effective?
This would require trials to find out the exact length based on the concentration that you're giving to each person. The researchers who have proposed this to Health and Human Services at the federal level argue that they believe it could be 2 months or more. However, unlike other products, they believe it would be safe to administer it over and over. So, you know, you'd give this to folks who are going to be healthcare workers for 8 weeks. And then, you know, based on how the trials are structured, you could administer it again as another inoculation, envisioning it quite like a booster later on if a vaccine is not available yet.
And so far, nobody is experimenting with this? There are no trials at all?
No. And part of the reason for that is that manufacturers of these types of shots are not on board. I spoke to them myself. The researchers have been speaking to them for months. And at this time, those manufacturers, they're called fractionators when it's a plasma product. And those fractionators are focused on intravenous products that are being used to treat coronavirus patients in hospitals. And that work is being supported at some companies such as Grifols by the federal government. So until the federal government steps up and offers some sort of financial incentive for a shot like this, many critics say that there's no reason to expect that a manufacturer would step up and do it themselves.
But the federal government is, and we've reported on this, spending billions of dollars on a vaccine moonshot. So why wouldn't it divert some of that money to this?
It's a great question. Many people are asking it. It does seem, again, because this hasn't been scaled up, we're talking very much in estimated figures, but the scientists who have designed clinical trials for this, they're proposing something that has a very modest price tag compared to vaccine development. Because keep in mind, just like the intravenous products that we've been hearing about for the last couple of months, you're taking antibodies from blood donors, you're concentrating them into a shot, and you're injecting people. So it's not nearly, the process is not nearly as intensive as designing an entirely new vaccine. And that's why Operation Warp Speed is so much more expensive.
So is it because of the financial rewards or the potential financial rewards from a vaccine that the private sector is not interested in pushing the government to do this?
The private sector says that is not the reason. They've come forth and argued that they are simply concentrated on moving as fast as they can toward scaling up products that are for treating patients. They say there's absolutely no financial reason why they've chosen that over the injectable shots. Obviously, the companies that are pursuing a vaccine are different than the plasma companies, so they haven't chosen a vaccine over a short-term immunity shot. But certainly, you know, many supply chain experts will explain that in the plasma world, intravenous products are much more profitable than these old-fashioned shots. And in part because when you administer something in a hospital ward in an IV drip, it's much more diluted and you don't need nearly as many antibodies to produce that product as you would for an injection.
I think probably a fair amount of people listening to this right now are wondering, how can I get my hands on one of these shots? Is it absolutely impossible?
They just don't exist. They do not exist right now. So unfortunately, no. The researchers behind the original proposal, who are now backed by some of the top plasma researchers in the country who are doing experiments at Johns Hopkins and Mayo Clinic, they've taken to Capitol Hill. They're writing letters to Nancy Pelosi, to various senators and Congress members, urging them to put pressure on groups like BARDA to fund this at some level, to try to create a financial incentives for companies to create these shots and to deploy trials that could get this underway in thousands of people.
And again, BARDA is the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, and that's a federal agency. They would be in charge of rolling this out.
BARDA, yes. BARDA is the branch of Health and Human Services Department that is responsible for all coronavirus countermeasures. So they have been soliciting proposals from doctors and scientists over the past several months and have been selecting various projects to pursue. At this point, they're at 51 different projects, but this is not among them.
Well, Emily, thank you so much. Fascinating.
Thank you for having me.
Emily Baumgartner from the LA Times. Coming up, some escape new movies. We'll have your Friday film reviews next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Friday, and two of my favorite cinephiles are here to discuss some essential viewing for the weekend. It'll be a hot one, so best to stay inside and watch movies. Roth Cornett is head of creative for Fandom and Screen Junkies. Hi, Roth.
Hello.
And Tim Gerson is senior U.S. critic for Screen International and a contributing editor at Mel Magazine. Welcome back, Tim.
Hi, Madeline.
Let us begin with The Old Guard. This is a big action thriller starring Charlize Theron and directed by Gina Prince-Bythewood, out on Netflix today, and here's a clip.
You can call me Andy. I lead a group of soldiers, fighters, like you.
With an extremely rare skill set.
What do you mean?
Let's just say we're very hard to kill.
So you good guys or bad guys?
Depends on the century.
So we really never die.
All right, Roth, do-gooder vampires?
Kind of. They're not exactly vampires. And in fact, their nature is not entirely revealed, which is just fine. There's maybe the Highlander It's kind of like the Eternal Warrior, which we've seen before. But what's neat about this film is that it's both really well constructed and choreographed in terms of the action. They really, really feel like a team of people that have, in fact, been working with each other for centuries and therefore understand each other's movements. It's a lot of setup. It's a fair bit of backstory, so it really does feel like it's more than a franchise, a movie franchise, almost setting up a television series. At the same time, it's not done so completely lacking in a full story that it feels like you have been cheated by the end of the movie, which I think is a little bit of a risk when you're setting something up quite this much. It does have a full story. You feel satisfied by the end. You're left wanting more, which I think is all the things that they would want from you. It's very frothy and it's very light. It's very silly, but it's well acted and it's well directed and it's fun. And maybe we need a bit of that.
Wow, because it looks like from the trailer that it's really dark and there's tons of violence and a lot of gunplay.
Oh, yeah.
Which maybe is light and frothy in these times, Tim.
Well, I think to Roth's point, it's a movie that is very kind of escapist and very kind. I mean, there aren't comic book movies right now. There aren't superhero movies, and The Old Guard is kind of the closest that we have at the moment. And so it has kind of that dark tone to it in terms of these immortal beings work together and, you know, in terms of all the superpowers, being able to live forever is kind of both blessing and curse. That's been explored in other comic book things and obviously vampire stuff. And so there is a darker side to the film in terms of the sacrifices that these characters have had to make and the things that they've sort of experienced over the 500 or how many years they've been walking the earth. For me, I like the movie too. And I think what makes the film really work is that this movie has, I think, more heart than maybe some other comic book superhero action movies sometimes have, because you really do get, to Roth's point, you kind of get the sense of who these people are, how they know each other, and kind of how nuanced they are as individuals. Even the bad guys in this film are actually more interesting and more complex than tend to be in these types of movies. And because of that, the ending is, I found, really emotional. In terms of an action movie, I think in a lot of ways we've sort of seen this kind of movie before. But in terms of like the emotional bonds between characters, why they're doing what they're doing and what the stakes are, that's more poignant than maybe people are expecting.
And why are they doing what they're doing and what are the stakes?
Well, they are working together, and they have a new recruit played by Kiki Layne, who is in If Beale Street Could Talk, and she discovers that she is also an immortal, and people don't exactly know how it happens. It just happens. And they've tried to keep their group a secret so that the world does not find out about this, but a terrible, horrible bad guy who is part of a big pharma group wants to capture them and take their DNA, because basically if you could sell a drug that would make you immortal, you would be very, very rich and successful. So part of the team is captured. The rest of the team have to go and rescue them.
It's kind of interesting to look at these movies now through the lens of our current COVID situation. They do look different, don't they, Roth?
I think they do, and I should say and note that sometimes what I consider to be light and frothy isn't always in line with everybody else. But what I think I mean by that, and I would say the same thing about Palm Springs, is that it's not demanding anything of me as a viewer in the way that another film might, that I might even enjoy more or think is better as a film. Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets, which is one that we're going to talk about, is demanding a lot more of us as a viewer than either of these other films are. And so for me, the experience feels escapist.
Okay, let's move on then to Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets. This is a film/documentary about a shuttering Las Vegas dive bar, its community of regulars, its barflies, and here's a clip.
Hello. You're just in time for the Knot party. We're not having fun in celebration of Knot closing.
Anybody want a drink, a shot, tell a story? You can always come to this ball.
And feel like family.
And feel like family.
To the bar! We're to the bar!
All right, Tim, talk about this. This is a not quite documentary from what I understand.
Yeah, it's technically a hybrid documentary is the term they're going with. But there's the story and then there's the real story. The story of the film is that there's this bar, a dive bar in Vegas called the Roaring Twenties. And this film is going to document its final day, its closing after tonight. And all the regulars come in throughout the day and sort of reminisce and hang out for one last kind of blowout before the bar closes forever. The actual story is that the filmmakers, Bill and Turner Ross, who are brothers, staged an event. They actually live in New Orleans, and this location that we see is actually not in Vegas, it's in New Orleans. They got a place, called it the Roaring Twenties, and they cast either people that they had met at dive bars or through casting sessions, telling them, we want to make a film about the last night at a dive bar. Because what the Ross brothers are trying to do is create kind of an experience that transcends any specific situation that would happen and do sort of a universal idea of what would it be like for all the patrons at one bar to say goodbye to each other. They essentially had all of their non-actors play themselves, just be themselves, and throughout the night, the Ross brothers would introduce new characters and new situations that they didn't know were going to happen and just let all of these non-actors just sort of improvise. In some ways, the movie is, these don't exist anymore, but immersive theater experiences where you buy a ticket and you are, say, going to someplace in the 1970s and it turns out to be an undercover spy mission, or you're kind of play acting those types of immersive theater things. In some ways, that's what's going on in Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets.
And Roth, what did you think?
You know, I will make a confession, which is that I was in a very rare experience, blissfully unaware of any of the backstory. So it was actually a really interesting experience watching the movie for me as I tried to suss out, because it was listed as a documentary, what was happening. And then it became very clear in moments that it was not a documentary and could not have been. But that said, what it feels like ultimately is like they're in a immersive group therapy role-playing session where they forget they're in the session because they're immersed. And so we actually do feel a little bit like a fly on the wall in their emotional life, if not their literal life. So stage actor Michael Martin, who to some degree plays a character adjacent to himself in the movie, is frankly one of the best actors I've ever seen. And he is by far the most compelling character in this film. He plays a character named Michael, who is a down and out actor who has given up on life and resigned himself to living in a bar. But he spends most of the movie trying to take care of people, create a sense of community, and warn those younger than himself about how frankly boring it is to be a person who has given up on yourself, that used to do things and now does nothing. It becomes utterly compelling to watch. And you also do feel like it is pointedly a blend of realism and absolute deception. And there's something beautiful about that, because it's inhabited by people who are down on themselves, trapped in these endless stories about themselves that become the traps that they're trying to drown out, if that makes sense.
The clash between reality and fiction is a perfect segue to our final film, Palm Springs. It's a rom-com starring Andy Samberg and Kristen Milioti, where two characters live the same day over and over again. Here's a clip.
It's one of those infinite time loop situations you might have heard about.
That I might have heard about.
The second you fall asleep, it all just goes back to the start.
I drove all the way back home to Austin, and I still woke up here.
One time I smoked a bunch of crystal and made it all the way to Equatorial Guinea. It was a huge waste of time.
Well, then what's the point of living?
We kind of have no choice but to live.
Let's waste some time.
All right, Roth, is it Groundhog Day Redux?
A little bit, but it certainly has kind of, it understands that you know Groundhog Day. So there's certain aspects of the rules of how a time loop works that it moves away from and doesn't get into a trap around. There's many, many elements of what's happening that it just doesn't explain, which is great. I have to say, This is Milioti's breakout role. She is incredible in this film. She's so talented all the time, but she pretty much steals the show. There's a very small moment early in the film that is uniquely hilarious, honest, surprising, and just the center of how quirky and odd she is. And it sets up the entire performance, but it also sets up the emotional stakes because she has this overblown reaction that we later understand that it's rooted in real emotional stakes. It is a rom-com, it's a time loop, it's a comedy. She is just as full a character as he, and I really enjoy it.
And yet, Tim, very reminiscent of our current reality. This idea that we can't escape the everydayness.
Yeah, it's funny because this movie premiered at Sundance. I did not see it at Sundance. I only saw it about a week ago. And so I thought, boy, it would have been nice to have watched this pre-pandemic. But I agree with everything that Roth said. I think the movie is really fun, really good. The two things I would add is that I like that the film, as opposed to Groundhog Day, which I also like, does not suggest that there is some sort of mystery that the main characters have to solve. They don't have to better themselves to get out of the loop. As that clip sort of suggested, they're just kind of stuck in it. And that actually works really well in terms of our current pandemic, because that's kind of where we are. Not only are we stuck, there's not a lot that we can do. And I think that inadvertently, Palm Springs really kind of speaks to this idea of being kind of stuck in a moment you can't get out of. And I think that that is really, really, really like well done. The other thing I would just add is that I just think that the movie is this great metaphor for romantic relationships, because these two people are strangers, but because they're the only people stuck in this time loop, they realize they're going to have to spend a lot of time together. They start to develop feelings for one another, and it creates this real dilemma, which is, what are they going to do if they pursue this relationship and it doesn't work?
All right. Thanks, you guys. Happy weekend. And hopefully one day we'll get out of this time loop. Roth Cornett, head of creative for Fandom and Screen Junkies. Tim Grierson, senior U.S. critic for Screen International and a contributing editor at Mel Magazine. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, why not see Palm Springs at the drive-in?
Drive-in movie theaters were really suffering. Real estate prices were going up and people just weren't going anymore. And then along comes coronavirus and the place was packed.
A socially distanced communal experience is having a resurgence. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Well, what wouldn't you give to hear that annoying little jingle as you sit in a cool theater watching a summer blockbuster and contemplating going to a lobby to get yourself a treat? Well, with movie chains shut down and people longing to get out of the house, the drive-in movie is back. Yes, they still exist, these theaters. In fact, Palm Springs, which we just reviewed, is at the Mission Tiki in Montclair this weekend. Chris Lee is a movies reporter for Vulture, and he recently stopped by the Mission Tiki, and he joins us now to tell us what that was like. Hi, Chris.
Hello. The Mission Tiki is a very faded, nostalgic movie theater. I think it was built during the Eisenhower administration when Elvis's Heartbreak Hotel was the number one song in the country. Oh. And in recent years, it hadn't been doing so well. Like, you know, with at a time that theatrical movie going was down across the board, drive-in movie theaters were really suffering. Real estate prices were going up and people just weren't going anymore. And then along comes coronavirus, and the place was packed when I went, and I just went up to a few people with my mask on and said, "What brought you out tonight?" And they said, "We don't care what movie is playing. We just want to get out of the house. We just want to, you know, basically right. have a collective cultural experience, you know, being out here, and we want to see movies."
And so, what movie was showing? at the time when you were?
There weren't a lot of new titles. There were a lot of what they call catalogs. I think Knives Out was playing, which came out earlier in last.
Well,
came
that's
out last
a good
year,
movie.
Bloodshot and The Invisible Man. But people said, you know, we could be watching anything. We just want to be here together and outside.
Well, it's funny because they're not really together. Everyone's still in their own separate cars. But there is a feeling of a communal experience.
You know, people go as a group. So, you know, be it two people, it's not just one person alone in their car. It usually is a group of friends, or maybe two groups will, you know, two cars will pull up together and they'll pull out some folding chairs and then have a little al fresco picnic. So there is a togetherness that's implicit.
How does it work? Is it the way it worked in days of yore where you would tune to like a station on your car radio and listen?
I think in days of yore, you would put a little speaker in the window of your car. But yeah, there's a frequency that they let you know. You tune your radio, your car radio to that, and then the audio of the movie is broadcast in there. But, you know, it's still a communal experience because you can hear everyone laughing or cheering or gasping all at the same time in accord with what's going on the screen.
How come there isn't an app you can put on your phone and then everyone could have headphones? Or that
There's
ruined the experience.
There's not an app for everything. this is not the most cutting-edge technology at these movie theaters. So we'll have to write them a letter about that.
So they must be gratified that there's this silver lining for them because they were facing an uncertain future or a non-existent future.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the exhibition community at large is pretty happy about what's going on at drive-in movie theaters because this is the only silver lining to what has been a, you know, devastating situation for theatrical movie going. As you mentioned at the top of the broadcast, the largest chains in the country are all shuttered because of anti-gathering measures. And, you know, there's suddenly this unexpectedly robust business. So, you know, people that worried that they were going to go out of business with drive-in movie theaters are suddenly, you know, having some of the most robust profits in recent memory. And, you know, as far back as the spring, they're saying, you know, we're enjoying summer blockbuster-like success with, you know, without any summer blockbusters being programmed because all of them have been either postponed or canceled or pushed into later this year or next year. But with a random group of old movie titles playing in the theaters, they're really packing audiences in.
So does that mean the studios are now going to look at drive-ins as a place to open their big new movies?
I highly doubt that, just because you can't operate the volume business at a drive-in movie theater that you could at a normal movie theater. And what's more, there are only 305 official drive-in movie theaters across the country. Although, as we may discuss later in this broadcast, there are numerous pop-ups, like hundreds of pop-up drive-in movie theaters coming into being across the country.
Yeah, one of which is the Rose Bowl. Aren't they doing a pop-up drive-in?
Yeah, the Rose Bowl, in conjunction with the Tribeca Film Festival, has started doing a drive-in movie series earlier this month. And Palm Springs played last night, which is a Hulu title. It premiered at the Sundance Film Festival and is getting great reviews. And they're programming a lot of movies. In fact, locally, there are a couple of others. There's the San Fernando Summer Drive-In Nights Festival, which is at the Westfield Fashion Square Mall in Sherman Oaks. And at the Americana Mall in Glendale, there's the Level 8 Drive-In, which is organized to take place on top of their parking garage. So, we're seeing a lot of that locally in addition to the Mission Tiki.
And are they going to program other stuff like concerts or anything else that's not exactly movies?
Yeah, this is the big new thing. So earlier this month, Garth Brooks established basically a new business model. He and his team booked 300 outdoor venues across North America, and they programmed a concert of his. It was $100 per vehicle, and I think 350,000 people nationwide came to see Garth perform. And this is the largest ever one-night show staged at drive-in theaters. Now, people had been wondering if this was viable. This was a huge, huge success. And I think it got not just – drive-ins are not just viable suddenly for moviegoers, but, you know, for people who want to see amplified music, this might be your only chance to check that out. And following in his footsteps is Blake Shelton, who on July 25th has his own 300 locations booked across North America, and he's going to have another one of these concerts featuring Gwen Stefani and another country artist named Trace Adkins.
Hmm. So did you ever think, you're a movies reporter, did you ever think that you'd be talking about the drive-in movie theater?
No. No, I just thought it was completely irrelevant. I mean, yeah, it's such a relic. It's such a quaint afterthought. You know, when you think about the movie business and the billions of dollars that are generated, you just don't really think about showing up in your car anymore. But I mean, it's a wonderful thing to do. And if your listeners are thinking about going, I highly recommend it. What you do is you, if you're in a pickup truck or in an SUV, you pull it around so that the back faces the movie screen. You open up the hatchback or lay down back there. You've got your snacks. I mean, you're automatically social distancing. You don't have these concerns about disinfection or hygiene. And, you know, especially in these summer months, it's a wonderful thing to do.
Mm, sounds really great. Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Chris Lee, he's a movies reporter for Vulture. Coming up, bartenders are out of work, so now some of them are delivering their drinks. Evan Kleinman is here with the best to-go cocktails next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lancho?
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15-minute bake-off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bam right there.
Pie.
Well, you now know what that means. It's time for our weekly Cooking with Evan food segment. And we're going to talk about drinks today, because you can get a lot of to-go cocktails now. And Evan Kleinman is here to tell us about some of the best ones. Hello.
Hello. I think we could all use a drink about now, no?
Not just one in some
Not just
cases.
One.
So you asked listeners for their favorite to-go cocktails.
It was really interesting. I did a shout out. I asked for their favorite to-go cocktails. I was very clear. But it seems that a lot of people are just doubling down on the cocktail hour at home, which is great. But some are ordering out, and I've gotten a couple. You know, it's easy to think of big name restaurants that we know and love, where we went and had a great meal and a great cocktail, as having really deep pockets. But any independent restaurant right now is hurting. So from Bertie G's in Santa Monica, Father's Office in Culver City, to Redbird and Orsa and Winston downtown, the restaurants you love are making cocktails for delivering to go. So if you're missing your favorite restaurant cocktail, it's most likely available with some really great food too. And you'd be doing a mitzvah. That means a good thing.
And you also have people who will deliver cocktails to your house and just the cocktails without the food.
Yeah, there are, you know, we focused so much on the destruction and horror going on in the restaurant business that we often forget about all the bartenders that are now out of work. So many of them have pivoted and are doing a lot of really interesting things. One man, Cedric Ransberg, he was the bar manager at the Prince Restaurant in Koreatown. And what he's done is he's making batch cocktails, and a lot of bars are doing that. They're making batch cocktails, which means it's not just one drink. So it's also more affordable. So he's making two cocktail batches in a kind of Capri Sun-like pouch, and he will...
So you can actually drink it through a straw.
Yeah. And Perfect. You can open it up and pour it over ice. Or you could freeze it and squeeze it and turn it into a slushie. I mean, you know, there's a lot to do with that little pouch. But Cedric will bring it to you. He's delivering all over LA County. And to find him, you go to Instagram at _goodiebags, which is what he's calling these little pouches. And you can order a Srirachita, which is a take on a spicy margarita, or a summer old fashioned with peach, or a strawberry banana daiquiri.
Okay, what's another one?
So another one that is just another quirky thing for drinking at home are live wire canned cocktails. And Aaron Polsky is one of the most famous LA bartenders. I mean, he's world renowned. He's kind of known as the rock star bartender from Harvard and Stone. And he had been thinking about doing canned cocktails for a really long time. Apparently, it's a segment of the market that's increased hugely over the last several years. And so what he's done is he's reached out to bartender friends of his. They have created drinks. They're their recipe. So Aaron says that these bartenders are being paid for their intellectual property rather than their labor. Just as an example, Joey Bernardo of Harvard and Stone is featured. His is a Honeydew Collins, a mix of gin, honeydew, coconut, lime leaf, and elderflower. A friend on Twitter talked about Livewire as being patio pounders. You can buy like a 4-pack, keep them in your fridge, and whenever you just want a drink, you just pop it open, pour it over ice, and have a nice drink at home. They're available either on the Livewire website or at Domain LA, Thunderbolt, and Barkeeper. So that's a fun thing. Other restaurants that I love, because the whole thing about being able to serve drinks is if you're a bar, it has to come in a can or it has to be in a closed bottle. But if you're a restaurant serving food, then you can just get a cocktail in a to-go cup. So yesterday I went to Mam Sur in Silver Lake to pick up dinner, and I ordered their zombie monster slushy, which was...
Did you then become a zombie monster after you drank it?
It had been so long since I had a really good cocktail that I just had such a great late afternoon. I was very happy.
What's in that?
Mezcal, tequila, tepache, and pineapple. Special Don's mix and spices. They're also making a frosé otter pop with rosé, gin, watermelon, lime leaf, and coconut.
So that's like in the plastic sleeve?
Yeah.
And you just suck on it?
Yeah.
Okay. I like that.
But I heard from people on Twitter that obviously they're going to their neighborhood restaurants for cocktails too. Like Little Dom's on Las Feliz has both bottled cocktails and made-to-order classics. And down in Orange County, Alta Baja is known for their Michelada menu. And they're now selling a kit to take home. It's, I think, $30, but you get a 6-pack of Mexican lager, a 16-ounce container of the Mish mix, along with tahin, lemon, and a corresponding garnish. And you pick whatever flavor is of their Michelada menu. I always love the Marimera, which is the classic, but they have a whole menu of Micheladas, which are, of course, beer cocktails.
Yeah. Okay, so that's making it at home with a little help.
Yeah.
What cocktail do you like to make at home? What's your favorite?
I'm very boring, maybe. I love gin and tonics, but I also love Negronis. And what I tend to do is I'll make a batch of Negroni mix, and then I'll either drink it as a straight Negroni over ice, or sometimes I'll pour some Negroni over ice into a glass, and then I'll put a splash of tonic or a splash of soda with it just to make it a little lighter.
And what's in a Negroni?
A Negroni is equal parts gin, Campari, and sweet vermouth. And then it is usually served with an orange garnish. And garnishing is something that I think is really important if you're going to make yourself a drink at home. Take the time. Give yourself a present. Sit down and enjoy it.
Yes. And then make another one. All right, Evan. Happy drinking.
Yeah, I'm going to go now and make myself some oleosaccharum.
I don't know what that is, but it sounds dangerous.
Oleosaccharum is a secret bartender thing where you just take a bunch of citrus rinds and you immerse them in sugar and close up the lid of the jar. And in a few days, what will happen is all the oil from those peels mixes with the sugar and becomes this insane liquid that is so tasty. And you can use it instead of sugar syrup in your drinks to balance things out.
Well, thank you for that tip.
I'm so
and
happy
all the other
help.
Tips. You are very helpful. Thank you. Go enjoy your cocktails. Evan Kleiman, host of KCRW's Good Food. And for a list of Evan's recommendations of to-go cocktails, go to our homepage at kcrw.com. Our producers are Rosalie Atkinson, Brian Hardzinski, Angie Perrin, and Catherine Barnes. Michelle Aloy is our line editor. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer. Amy Ta is our digital producer. Mario Saavedra and Phil Richards are our very technical and talented directors of technical stuff. I'm Madeline Brand. It looks like I've already gotten a start on the weekend. I hope you have too. I'll see you Monday.